Welcome to the Norris Group's Real Estate Radio Show. Hosted by author, investor, hard money lender, and real estate educator, Bruce Norris. Equipping California real estate professionals for tomorrow's challenges.
The following radio show is a live recording of the I Survived Real Estate event on August 23rd, 2008. The event brought together realtors, auctioneers, investors, mortgage professionals, economists, data providers, and builders to discuss how we got here, how the respective industries are changing, and how we move forward and prosper together in 2008 and beyond. Proceeds from the event went to the Orange County affiliate of the Susan G. Komen for the Cure. The event would not have been possible without the generous help of the following platinum partners: the San Diego Creative Investment Association and President Bill Tan, the Investors Workshops of Orange County and President Sean Watkins, MVT Productions, the audio video master behind the spectacular live production, White House Catering, who provided superb cuisine and outstanding service for the live event, Fry Wiles, the web development, internet marketing, and creative design firm that created the event site iSurvive2008.com, Proxibid, the online auction platform that aired the entire event online nationwide live, the Nixon Library, Pechanga Resort and Casino, the Chicago Bulls, the Denver Nuggets, and the Cleveland Cavaliers. See iSurvive2008.com for pictures, video, and more details on this historic event, brought to you by the Norris Group.
We got interviewed by Bloomberg News, and ever since then I've been getting called by Wall Street every day. You know what they want to know? They want to know where the bottom is. They think maybe I have a grasp on that. The same people that dreamed up mortgage-backed securities and nearly cost us our system are now putting together hedge funds for $1 billion to take advantage of the very houses they caused to be lost. I don't think I would like that to be a good solution. I think it's much better if you get a room full of these people times 10,000 across the country, and we'll solve it, keep it, and do a much better job of managing that inventory.
It's true, but one of the opportunities for the people here is something you identified. You showed all those properties that cost the bank $4 million. If there's a way for these pool people to come in and buy the properties at 30 cents on the dollar, which is what they're looking at, and keeping people in their homes by reducing the capital on the properties, it keeps a lot of those homes out of foreclosure, minimizes to a certain, at least gives the banks certainty as to what their losses are. So I'm not saying either is better than the other. I'm saying I think they're all going to be part of a very complicated integrated solution that we're going to need to get through this problem, because the numbers are never going to be worse than they are in the next couple of years.
Let me just add, I want to just respond to that one. H.R. 3221, part of what it does is allow HUD to buy the first at a discount. So literally in Moreno Valley, this is the way it would work. You'd have a $400,000 existing trust deed in Moreno Valley. The house is now worth $200,000. HUD would be able to offer $180,000 to the lender. That would be the short sale. The lender would take a $220,000 loss. The person would get to stay in the property, now only owe $180,000, plus there's other things. There's a second by HUD, and there's a partnership with HUD on future equity. Here's my biggest concern with that. The program is very isolated in that it's only available for someone that signed up for an adjustable mortgage that, when it changes, takes a very large portion of their income. The person that lives next door to them that struggled to qualify for a fixed loan is not eligible, and when they hear that they just live next door, now I really literally play this out every day when I go see a property that we buy. We're buying a house for $85,000, and the next door guy is watering his grass. This just happened to me. And I remember thinking, what if this poor guy understood that his house is just worth a third of what he owes on it? So here's my problem is that if I live next door to a guy that's let his grass grow brown, and then all of a sudden one day he gets revitalized and starts watering and planting, I might just be curious and walk over there and go, what's the deal? And he says, man, you won't believe it. He said, I don't owe $400,000 now, I owe $180,000. And I go, how do you get that plan? He says, you got to have this type of mortgage taken in between these kind of dates. And I didn't fib on my loan app, so I don't have it. I might be tempted to walk in a non-recourse state if it costs me $220 to stay. And that's the problem with the solution, is that the domino might be worse than the original problem. I'm not trying to be negative. I'm just playing this one out. Now, Philip, I want to ask you this question. Since you deal with people that make loan decisions constantly, is it becoming more acceptable in their minds to bail from a mortgage that they have?
Without a question, the conversation, I've had so many people come up to me recently, just in the last few months, specifically saying, don't talk to me about the moral.
Yeah, you emailed me, forget the moral conversation completely.
Tell me what it's going to do to my credit. Tell me what it's going to do to, can I buy this property, can I not? And that's why Fannie and Freddie put in that new guideline, like I spoke about in the speech. You know, my concern is that, based on what we're just talking about, is I see these bills passed, and I see how the government passes the bill that raised the Fannie Mae conforming limit to 729.5. And everyone thought that was going to have a huge stimulus to the economy, right? The problem is that we were excited about it. As lenders, we were thrilled. Wow, the new conforming loan limit's going to be 729. And then we got the guidelines, and we're like, well, it's not really. I mean, some loans can qualify at 729, but the majority of them were still down to the 417. So when I see these politicians passing these bills with these preconceived notions, it's going to give stimulus to the market, but then at the bottom line, people can't qualify.
Yeah. Now, see, I think I was going to just talk about what you said, Christopher. Is that at the end of the day, we got a median price that was ridiculous when you look at the median income of our state. And I guess we still have some more damage to do before we get back to some reasonable number.
Yeah, I mean, people always worry about not qualifying. Well, there's two solutions to that. You want to change the qualifications. Another 6 months of these price declines, and everybody's going to be able to qualify, right?
Yeah, affordable housing will kind of take care of itself, actually. Yes, sir.
Well, you've touched on something, though, Bruce, that I think is devastating for the society. Anything that you do to increase the lack of personal responsibility will eventually destroy a society. I'm absolutely convinced of that. And that is what you spoke about. If I have qualified and I am diligent on my $400,000 loan, and you give my neighbor a $200,000 discount because he was irresponsible, unfortunately, there was a gentleman that was president of the United States not long ago that I think set us on a track that we've all had to reap the rewards from. And I'm not a politician, but honesty, folks, is a very critical fabric for a society to survive on. Once you destroy that, then you're looking at something far bigger and far worse than the housing problem.
Christopher, I wanted to ask a question. This is sort of an economic question. It's twofold. We just saw Merrill Lynch accept 22 cents on the dollar for a $30 billion package of CDOs. Then when I read the fine print, they actually got about 5% in cash, and they carried back a note and guaranteed the pile. So they didn't get a lot for it. My question is, whose money was that? Whose dollars got discounted? Was Merrill Lynch ever capable of taking that personal hit? Or in other words, is that real people's money, like people in this room?
Well, I mean, if you're invested in Merrill Lynch, yeah, it's your cash. I mean, yeah, that's
no. I'm sorry.
But you're raising an interesting point, which is you know, what is the state of the financial system, right? So you brought that up. 22 cents on the dollar. They called it that, as if somehow the sale was complete and they were no longer exposed to the risk. You read the fine line; they're still exposed to that risk. In other words, this is nothing more than another sieve. It's just another special instrument vehicle. In this case, it's just a third party as opposed to some in-house, you know, accounting mechanism. The key point, I think, we have to understand about our financial system is, you know, whatever you're thinking housing is going through, understand that the financial system is a wreck right now. And the kind of – take IndyMac, for example. IndyMac rolled over. Their loan loss provisions that when they rolled over was about 0.5% or 1% of their overall value of the bank. The FDIC walks in, the first thing they say, within 24 hours, they go, yeah, we're going to take a $4 to $8 billion haircut in this bank. In other words, somewhere between 13 and 25% of the value of the bank. And every single bank is in this situation right now. So, you know, you're right. We got to worry about the housing market, but we also have to worry about these financial markets because no one's going to have any cash. So watch out there. It's a big mess.
Okay. Now, let's extend that one stage further. That bank, IndyMac, falling, took out a pretty good percentage of FDIC's liquidity. What, about 8% or something like that? Is that something that they'll just keep writing checks and that'll be fine?
No, they'll have to get bailed out, too.
Okay, that's going to be bailout, too. Does that have any repercussions down the road, either there's a lot of assets that are going down. Everybody's writing down their loan pile. Everybody that owns real estate here is recalculating their net worth every month, painfully so. Are we going to have not a depression, not a recession, but are we going to have deflation?
I have, for the life of me, and perhaps I'm too young of an economist, but I do not understand the deflation argument.
Okay.
I do not understand why, in the world of fiat currency, why you would ever have deflation. The Argentinians have proven many times that it's very easy to fight deflation. All right? You just turn on the printing press. So, no, I don't think deflation is an issue. All right?
And then the Japanese economy is always brought up.
But the Japanese central bank has always been phenomenally tight. I mean, they do things that economists just look at what they're doing. They go, why are you doing that?
Okay.
There's no sense of logic to some of the policies that their central bank has pursued.
Okay. Rick, you had mentioned something that probably fell through the crack, but I caught it. And it's because we've talked about it before. No, it's important. You said that there was something about a guy that was a farmer in
Tuscany
yeah. that had a say-so whether somebody got to modify his loan. Could you expand on that one just a little bit, or is that going to be too big a hole to go into?
No, I mean, it's the scenario where you and your neighbor both have identical loans on, because we're in California, identical properties in the same development. And I guess your garage door was brown and his was 10,
okay.
which is the big distinction. But you both have the same loans. Yours is held by the bank. His is put into a securitized pool, packaged up as a mortgage-backed security. And now we have somebody who's taking their retirement funds for the grape growers reunion in Tuscany. Good Chianti, by the way. And that person and a half dozen other investors like him now have to approve a loan modification on your neighbor's house before the servicer can go outside those parameters. So your bank can twist itself into a pretzel and reduce the principal amount on your loan, change the interest rates, do whatever they need to do. You can stay in your house. Odds are that group of investors will say, just cut your losses and move on to the next investment. So I do think one of the things you're going to see legislatively come out of this particular cycle is very, very close scrutiny on the role of securitization, and you're nodding, so you'd know this better than me, but the role of securitization in these loans. Right now, a lot of homeowners are losing their homes, and I don't have any number on that, just a lot, because they don't have the same flexibility with a securitized loan as somebody whose loan is held by the bank. That's why that behavioral shift to buy and distribute is so problematic from a legislative standpoint.
Okay. Now, part of H.R. 3221 is also saying that if there's a second, then that doesn't apply. You have to wipe that out first. It's interesting. You mentioned something about the foreclosure list. Whenever I go over the foreclosure list for some of the training that we do, I check it out very carefully. It's actually 10% in the R area in Riverside that is non-owner occupied. 10%. That's it. 90% owner occupied, but 70% of that 90% has a double. Simultaneous first and second at the time of purchase. That's how we purchase properties.
And what percent of that was 100% financing?
Oh, 100%, 100% of it.
Well, and one of the things we've always seen is the market priced refis at the same level it was pricing purchase money loans. And if you look at, this was true in the 80s and it was true in the 90s and it was true this time, the number of first payment defaults, who's surprised? There's no you have no skin in the game cash-wise. You get a refi, your credit's already bad. What is the threat? It's a moral threat, and the moral threat doesn't make any sense. Now, the good news is, if you really look at it, you can argue that there's probably 1.5 million homeowners in California who are underwater. Yet the debate on foreclosure, at least for the next couple of years, I think we'd all say somewhere between 400,000 and 500,000. So two out of three, despite the fact that it makes no economic sense, will stay in their homes. And, again, what happens if you really change the equation? And instead of, I'm less concerned about the ARM rates and their setbacks. I'm more concerned about how far prices drop, because that's going to be a much stronger determinant of how many people walk from their homes, frankly, than the resets.
Well, and not only that, Christopher, the unemployment rate is probably not, it's not peaked yet. It's probably going to head back.
Not even close.
Okay, if it's not even close, then some of those decisions get forced. and you're in a position of non-equity, then you don't have a choice. You're leaving for Utah, where we're actually hanging drywall still, and all of a sudden, you got to go. So that's an added problem. Anna Maria, you had said it was interesting, and somebody else just brought it up, that the now part of the lending business is being very cautious and restrictive and reining in everything. Doesn't that happen every time we go through one of these? Weren't we generous up until, let's say, 89, and then we went, oh my goodness, and then the 90s, did it get more restrictive as well? Okay.
I think a lot of it has to do with just governmental agencies in general wind up having a knee-jerk reaction to what happens, and then we see a bunch of laws that get drafted and put into place, and then we have laws that we can't really comply with, or like you were saying on the Fannie Mae guidelines and the raising of the loan limits and that sort of thing, and you just it's great because they want to protect the industry, but then you can't really do anything about it. So I do see that does happen quite often. You know?
Now you said you didn't think this would happen again.
Well, I don't think to this degree. I mean, that there's so many. You wouldn't believe all the laws that are trying to get passed and go into place on foreclosure prevention and loan modifications, and they're amending Regulation Z, and we have HERA now, which is HR 3221, and all the different states are they're in a mad panic. I just got back from an ARMOR conference in Minnesota, where I met with about 30 state regulators, and they're in sheer panic. They don't have the staff to try to roll out a lot of these laws.
What's interesting is, you know, we're creating all these laws after we let everybody in, mm-hmm. so now they can't refi to a safe place, so it has to be foreclosed on. And that's why it's interesting. I'm a big believer, after studying statistics, is that things are going to recycle again. We're going to get in a market that feels safe, lenders will get more aggressive, and then somebody's going to dream up the next form of securitization, and we'll play this role out again.
You know, this there's a longer run situation here that, I mean, you know, I hear like it's not going to happen again. It is going to happen again. Maybe not here. Maybe not in this market. But, you know, what are we, 8 years away from the dot-com debacle? You know, and it's like Wall Street came back to us and says, no, buy this bond. No, this time, really, we mean it. It's good, you know. We bought that, and it blew up in our face. And what's the next thing they're going to sell to us? We live in a world in which real returns are falling. We have more and more saving, and for a variety of reasons, the real interest rate's falling, but we have a very, very competitive, almost more competitive than ever before, financial industry. And what that implies is, with greater competition, everybody's desperately trying to wring every little bit of returns they can out of the system, and as a result of that, they're constantly trying to funnel hidden risk into the system. And so if anybody's a long-run investor who wants to watch these markets and think about the future, you're constantly trying to see where Wall Street's slipping in the risk and trying to hide it from you. And that should be, you know, that should be, I think, something we should all understand, that the incentives in Wall Street are bizarre. And until we, as I think, as a nation, as a society, realize that and understand, well, you can't trust anything these guys say ever, no matter what, we're just going to keep happening again and again.
You know, when I've really enjoyed interviewing economists, and I've always been absolutely shocked by their ability to come up with different conclusions to exactly the same data and then make it sound reasonable. And actually, I think they believe it, and so do their membership. And I guess that's the hardest part, is that there's probably a lot of people trying to make career decisions based on this is what's going to play out. And one of the things, you know, there's, well, for instance, right now, when we look at a notice of default chart that's grown enormously, we know that that's converting at 78% of the time to a trustee sale, which is converting 99.5% of the time to an REO. You just look at the NOD and convert two quarters away, you can look at the pile and say, this is ridiculous. This is going to cause a giant problem. The numbers, and I don't have these charts with us, but in comparison to anything we've experienced before, the foreclosure numbers of the 80s compared to the volume of sales, the sales dwarfed the foreclosures. It was minuscule even at its worst. And that was one of the charts we saw, 27,000 against 400,000 sales. This time, let's say in Riverside, let's go to the 90s. The 90s had twice as many sales in a quarter as we did have foreclosures. This time we have the exact opposite. We have twice as many foreclosures as we have sales, a multiple of four times as bad as the 90s.
Well, there's two things happening there. One, the 90s, because foreclosures were driven mostly by unemployment, the rate was about half of what it is today in terms of converting a delinquency to an actual foreclosure. The interesting question, and this is a question I struggle with in this market, is although you never got to the percentage of sales that were foreclosure driven in the 90s, it went on for a long, long time. You had about 7 years there where prices were down or flat, and 7 years where you were at about 65% of what was maximum sales activity. So it was a very long period. If you add it all together, and I haven't done it for a while, it actually is still far short of what we're going to experience over this cycle on foreclosures, any way you measure it. But it's not quite as far as short as it might be. So the real question here to me is we've had prices come down 40% in a very quick period, or we can argue in some markets 65%, no question about it, from peak to valley. And the question is the market going to clear faster? And that's kind of the dilemma I'm dealing with. And I deal with that also from the public policy perspective. The best solution to me in many ways, although I spend a lot of my time dealing, lobbying otherwise, the best solution is letting the market clear. And the market is clearing. I think the point I wanted to make, and I don't know if I made it well, is that the market is clearing. The thing that surprises me right now is how many sales there are. I am stunned by the fact that we're up, and I think you're going to see that more for the next quarter. I'm stunned by the fact we're up so far, and I don't think it's investor sales, by the way. I think it's too hard to get a loan right now. So it's actual principals buying a home, and in part because the prices, two things are happening. One, it's almost as cheap to buy as it is to rent. In some instances, it is cheaper.
Absolutely.
You know,
and
all those homes you showed, clearly cheaper.
That's right.
And those, you know, are sophisticated sales, but it's cheaper. The second thing is you're below replacement costs. The problem the builders are having, we saw it last time too, but you're basically, in some instances, the replacement costs are twice what the actual sales prices are in new property right now. So that's good news in a sense for investors. It tells you that you're probably somewhat closer to the floor, but the real question is this clearance going to actually be a real clearance, or are we seeing something of a false dawn?
You know,
because part of the danger of the prices dropping is instead of having those 400,000 or 500,000foreclosures, nothing to do with resets, people just say, I'm not going to do this anymore. The moral incentive is gone, and people just walk away because that's the rational economic thing to do.
In Grand Junction, Colorado, in the 80s, I was in there in about 1985 and made an offer for all of the HUD repos in one shot. When we bought those, they were condos. They were in fourplex form. We bought them. We bought them for $10,000 a door. We set all those comps, so that made everything worth 10 grand one at a time. The price got down to 8 grand a condo. You had to rent the condo for 200. There was no one that would buy the condo for 8 grand. Their payment would have been 80 bucks. And that's how scary the market was. So the price per month sometimes doesn't dictate you're going to have a big rush to buy it if there's fear about the market. And that's, you know, that's one of the things that can be a false indicator. Yes?
I talked to a guy who handled the REO assets for a credit union at the California Mortgage Brokers Association conference a couple weeks ago. And he wondered if we could get him a list of who held the firsts on his loans. That was my initial response. Now, he was on about his fourth martini, chewing on the olives, and so I probed this a little bit. I said, well, with all due respect, it would seem to me that that information would be in your customer files. You took an application, you'd want to know who had the first on the loan, what the loan amount was, and, you know, logical things like that. And he said, no, we don't have that in any of the files. That's why I'm looking to buy the information from you. And I said, it didn't occur to you to find out anything about the first mortgage? He said, no, we did almost no research on the original one. This is right out of his mouth. We did no research on the first mortgage or on the home buyer. We just got an assessment on what the house was worth, and if it was worth a certain amount of money, we wrote the loan.
You've been listening to the Norris Group Real Estate Radio Show.
For more information on the Norris Group, please visit www.thenorrisgroup.com.